Hey everyone, I'm Kyle.
And I'm Gary.
And today we have a very special guest.
Very, very special.
We have Pete Enns on the show today.
OMG, like, I want to start a fan club for him.
This is a dream come true. Like, when we started the podcast, I was like, this is going to be great. But it'd be really cool to have someone like Pete on. And I was like, that's a pipe dream. There's no way. But we got to talk to him today, and it was so good.
God lets his children tell the story of their experience from their ancient point of view. So, you know, ancient peoples, you know, what makes a God great? It's the God that lets you beat up other people and take their land. You can call that inspired in the sense that this is God allowing the ancient Israelites to talk about God in the only way that would make sense to them in that culture.
So we're super stoked for you to hear more from Pete, but basically here's what we're talking about today. Pete wrote a book that was extremely transformative for both Kyle and I and many of our friends called The Bible Tells Me So. And the premise of the book is, I mean, if we can break it down into simple language, I'd say Pete talks a lot about letting the Bible be what it is and not having so much of a posture to defend certain things about God or about scripture, but just to let the Bible act how it's going to act. And maybe another way to say that is he kind of helps you to get into the frame of historical context and understanding what's really going on behind the scenes and not read the Bible so literally. So that might, I don't know, send some listeners off just alone with that phrase, but I think it's so helpful.
But it's Pete does this, like, such a good job of explaining it about how actually what he talks about actually values the Bible a lot more than you might think. So if you're like, I don't know about this, don't turn it off. Give it time, because Pete does a really good job of talking through some of this stuff. He also wrote a book. His newest book is The Sin of Certainty, which also addresses the issue of our need for certainty, especially in the West. And he also is the host of a new podcast called The Bible for Normal People.
Oh, it's so good.
Is an amazing name just in and of itself. It makes voices seem kind of like that's all you guys could come up with. That was a really cool name. But that's another excellent podcast where they keep fleshing this stuff out with different guests and just different conversations. And I think that they're doing some really good stuff over there as well.
Yes. So we are stoked for you to hear from Pete. So let's just let him take it away.
Hey, Pete, how's it going?
It's going great.
Great.
Well, here in Philadelphia.
Very nice. Well, how's the weather in Philly right now?
Well, it was hot last week, and this is typical. Now it's like cool and overcast. It's sort of like a Seattle day here. Mm. It's going to be like this all week. A little rainy. Can't do much outside.
Okay, so I'm a huge hockey fan. Does that mean you're a Penguins fan right now, or what's your sport?
I never got into hockey, and the thing is that I've gone to several, you know, hockey games, the Flyers and a couple other teams. It's an exciting sport to watch live, but I just didn't grow up doing it. Does Pittsburgh have a hockey team?
You know,
no, I'm not an idiot. I know the Penguins, blah, blah, blah.
I was going to say, we should just hang up now. Like,
that's I know. Well, that's one of the original Big Eight, right? The Pittsburgh Penguins, isn't that right? I mean, going back to the good old days.
Philadelphia would be the team for that one.
Okay.
Yeah. Pittsburgh came later in the game, but.
Did they? All right. Yeah. Well, now they have a hockey team apparently in Tennessee or something, which is.
It's just
not
weird.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not right. Not right. And in Dallas.
Yeah.
Of all the places.
What the heck's going on in the world that we live in here? Anyway.
Crazy things. All right. So, Pete, you have quite a long resume. And right now you also have launched a new podcast called The Bible for Normal People.
Yeah.
But when you're sitting on an airplane next to someone who you've never met before and they look over and they go, oh, like, hello, nice to meet you. What do you do? How do you normally describe that to them?
I put my earbuds in my ear and act like I'm sleeping because I'm an introvert. I don't want to be bothered on an airplane making small talk with strangers.
Oh, no.
Jesus doesn't need me to talk to that person. I'm convinced about that. So.
You and I just connected on a very deep level, right?
Yeah. Gosh. Anyway, yeah, well, I think, you know, I don't assume people know anything about what I do because, you know, one thing years ago, I coached Little League, and I coached my son for about 10 years playing baseball. And you meet people, and you know, I learned how to sort of answer that question by not assuming a single thing. Mm-hmm. What do you do for a living? Well, I teach, you know, at that point I was teaching in a seminary, and they didn't know what a seminary was, so I had to explain that. And I said, I teach the Bible. And they said, oh, the Bible, yeah. And then I say Old Testament. And I remember one person said to me, he said, oh, Old Testament, that's Genesis, right? I said, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's actually a pretty good answer, because a lot of people today can't give that answer. And that's before Jesus, right? He said, yeah, exactly right. That's before Jesus. And I'm surprised even, you know, at teaching at a Christian college, and I know this is ubiquitous, that first year students, you cannot assume they're coming in with any sort of knowledge of the Bible. So I've learned to not assume a single thing when I talk to people and they ask me what I'm doing. I usually just say college professor.
Yeah,
and
keep
then
it simple.
I say theology, because theology, enough people sort of can figure out a little bit that's about God or something, right? Yeah. And that's, if that's as far as it goes, I'm sort of happy.
Yeah.
But then I do put my earbuds in and I go to sleep.
Sweet deal.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So, like we said, you're the co-host of the Bible for Normal People podcast. And you've also written probably my favorite book, The Bible Tells Me So.
Wow.
And how would you describe, because I would love to talk about Bible Tells Me So for like hours and hours and hours. But if you had to put it into like a tweet form, which is difficult for this book. How do you normally describe the book?
I normally describe the book something like this. The Bible has a lot more to offer if we don't try to defend what we think it should be, and rather try to come to terms with what it actually is. Mm. That's one tweet form. Maybe something else would be, the Bible doesn't work well as a rule book for life or an owner's manual for the Christian life, but it does work well as modeling something for us of a journey of faith, although this is from ancient people and how they perceive things, but modeling a journey of faith where you're engaging God from where you are. And that's something we do too. We haven't arrived in our culture in some top of the mountain, like we have pure culture, or like culture never gets in the way. Where every human being, when they try to commune with God, we're doing so from our own baggage, our own cultural moment, our own assumptions about the nature of reality. And I think it's fascinating that the Bible actually reflects that in multiple ways, in you know, various levels and various topics. And that's, I think, a comfort to me anyway, that the Bible is very approachable in that sense. It's not just mountaintop experience. It's people really struggling with faith based on where they are. That's a long tweet.
So, yeah, that'd be a lot of characters, but it's cool.
Yeah, no.
So, okay. Just like Kyle said, that was one of those very transformative books for me personally that I read. And so that was one of the reasons we wanted to get you on the show was, gosh, this book, more people need to hear about it, need to read it. So as we're talking about The Bible Tells Me So, one of the things I've heard you say oftentimes is let the Bible be what it is, something along those lines. And that's something it seems like you address in different ways through this book. So what do you mean by that? Like, what does that really mean, to let the Bible be what it is?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's actually hard to do that. You know, I don't think it's easy. Oh, just let the Bible be what it is. But I'm trying to push people to examine their own assumptions of what we bring into the discussion. And if we can't really find it in the Bible, maybe to start questioning those assumptions that we have. Like, you know, the Bible, because it's the Bible, is historically accurate whenever it talks about history. Okay, that's an assumption, but let the Bible be the Bible. Read the text, and I think people would normally come to a different conclusion depending on what you're reading. But, you know, you've got two histories of Israel. You've got four Gospels. Mm-hmm. They don't agree.
Yeah.
And to force them to agree is, you're not letting the Bible be the Bible at that point. You're trying to impose on it something that is alien to the text itself, and therefore, in my opinion, not a good reading of the Bible, and not a high view of the Bible, but actually a pretty low view of the Bible when it's not good enough.
Okay, now that probably pissed off somebody listening to this right now.
Hey, man, it's what I do. You know, as long as I don't sign my paycheck, I really don't care. No. Actually, I do. No, kidding around. I mean, I do care because I understand the discomfort, let's say, and the unsettledness of thinking differently about the Bible. But I also want to say I don't bear responsibility for that in a sense.
Okay.
Right, because it's not, oh, ends, you're ruining the Bible for us. Well, no, I think it was ruined for you a long time ago, where rather obvious things like Chronicles and Samuel Kings do not agree in detail. Genesis is clearly not science. Those kinds of things are troubling to you. That means someone got to you early on and presented you with the text that needs so much constant tending, you know, like a garden where the flowers are not going to bloom unless you water them four times a day and feed them fertilizer. And even then they still die. It needs so much tending and so much grooming and so much attention that you begin to think, is this what the Bible is supposed to be doing? Right. So I'm not trying to be funny. It's not my fault that you're having a faith crisis. You know, it's not because what I'm saying is not private opinion. It's not something that I just dreamed up with yesterday to try to be innovative. It's fairly mainstream biblical scholarship that has been going on for several centuries now, literally. And not everything biblical scholars say is right. Biblical scholars disagree, but there are mainstreams of opinion that have really stood the test of time that I think it's best to sort of get on board with those things precisely to help the faith, not to hurt it.
Yeah. So what's the journey been for you then? So I imagine you maybe grew up with a certain understanding of here's how you approach the text, and then you've been on this journey to where you're at now. So what was kind of the process in all of that to get you to the place to write a book like Bible Tells Me So and do this new podcast that you're doing?
Well, I think my little process might not be the same as a lot of people who might be listening to this podcast and to mine as well. I didn't grow up in what you would call an evangelical or fundamentalist home. I grew up in a sort of Christian home with parents who were German immigrants. So they didn't have the language of evangelicalism or anything. And I didn't grow up thinking that you have to toe the line or God's going to be mad at you. That was not remotely anything that I had in my upbringing. Now, I had a conversion experience at a fairly conservative church when I was 16. But by that point, the damage was done. You know, I wasn't going to fly around and just sort of like play the game and give the right answers. And I've always been sort of a questioning person, you know, and this it's just my personality. So for me, there wasn't a lot of stress in terms of my inner spiritual state in working through this. The stress for me was always much more, what are other people going to say when they know what I think? And that has happened to at various levels and various times in various ways. And I don't mean that that I was playing sort of a deception game. I don't do that. But I also know that I can't expect other people to have processed what I've processed when I've gone to school basically, you know, after college for 9 years doing this stuff. You know, you come to different levels of detail and understanding that I can't expect other people to process. And so for me, it's more like, you know, they have no idea what I think about this. And if I told them, they'd go screaming into the night or something. And that's to me, that's always been more of the stressor, you know, rather than my own. But, you know, I mean, not to ramble here too much, but it's not like I'm not challenged personally by there are ways of putting the Bible together where you don't need God at all.
Okay.
That can happen. You can do that. I mean, plenty of people do that. And not to get too far into this, but I'm trying to I think of inspiration as a way that can actually incorporate that reality that, you know, the Bible is very much rooted in its cultural context. It does look a lot like other texts of the time. And that's not always the most comfortable thing to think about.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, and I'd be lying if I said, that's a piece of cake. You know, no, there are days I'm like, what the heck's going on?
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
But I think that's also part of the journey of faith that the Bible itself bears witness to in its own ancient way when they're struggling with God and struggling with God's reality in their lives and things like that.
So what was maybe you can bring up one example that you take on in your book to give an example of like, okay, here's maybe a text that you've read a certain way. Now, let me give you some historical context, some background on this. Can you give us one of those examples to help our listeners get a gauge on here's what you're trying to do and how you're trying to help people approach the Bible?
Yeah, I mean, it's not even like I always read this way, but then I saw something and I have to read it another way. It's more like I never noticed it.
Okay.
And one of the things for me, like getting to graduate school and studying with Jews, I started reading the Bible. It's like, why did I never see this before? It's so,
and moreover,
why did nobody ever show this to me before? Right. Those are more the experiences I had. But one example that I use early on in The Bible Tells Me So really is an example that in a way started it all for me in an earnest way. And that's something that Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. It's a specific passage where he's talking, he's doing his sort of like Christ-centered interpretation thing, which Paul does on the Exodus and then on the wilderness period. And he says in verse 4 something like, the Israelites, they drank from the same, they ate the same spiritual food, which is the manna. And Christians have like a manna too, right? That's the manna is Jesus. And they drank from the same spiritual rock that followed them. And that rock is Christ. And that's a very interesting little twist there because he's talking, of course, about the rock in – actually it happens twice in Exodus and in Numbers where water comes from a rock and gives the Israelites water to drink in the desert where there presumably isn't a lot of water to be had.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. I mean, for Paul to sort of bring that into the Christian reality and into the post-resurrection Jesus stuff is like, that's exactly what Christians do with the Bible. They read the Bible in light of Jesus, which is, that's fine. But Paul adds this little thing, the rock that followed them. And that was like, okay, what's going on with that? And I was in graduate school, James Kugel, who was one of my professors at Harvard. I was a teaching assistant, one of the courses he was teaching in undergrad. And he mentioned this and, I said, wow, that's really interesting. But you see, there are Jewish texts that say the same thing or similar things where there was a well, a rock that rolled around the desert that followed the Israelites wherever they went. And that's an odd idea, but it's actually logical from a certain mentality. It's logical because if you think, you know, they had manna for 40 years, right?
Yeah.
But a supply of water, think about the logic. A supply of water is only mentioned twice in Exodus chapter 17 and in Numbers chapter 21. Or is it 20? One of those. I think it's 20 or 21. At the beginning and at the end of the wilderness wandering. So manna is throughout, but there's only water given twice. So the Jewish logic before the time of Paul and Jesus was, well, it's the same rock. And what that rock did is it accompanied the Israelites on their desert journey. And there are all sorts of texts from the Jewish world that basically say that. There's a supply of water that's sort of like a portable drinking fountain that the Israelites have access to. And I remember hearing that and saying, that's awfully silly. But then James Kugel says to the class, now turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4. And there it is. It's the same tradition. And it alerted me to, frankly, how Jewish Paul was, which, again, sounds odd to say.
Yeah.
But it's true, you know, and Jesus was Jewish too, by the way, and and not a Protestant, not an evangelical, not an inerentist, but
whoa,
a Jew. I'm sorry to break it to you, but, you know, but that's, you know, they with great respect for tradition and great respect for scripture, they were still products of their time in a sense, right? So when Paul says the rock that followed them, see, here's the kicker. Paul said that without thinking that he's, quote, adding to the Bible. Okay. Because Paul had an interpreted Bible. Paul had a Bible that had already been interpreted for him by Jews long before he ever came on the scene. And he sort of just incorporated this probably without thinking reflectively. It's sort of like an example that we could all relate to. At Christmas time, we tend to send Christmas cards to people. And if Mary's on there, she's probably on a donkey.
Yeah.
Right? Now, she's not on a donkey in any of the Gospels. Right? And how many wise men do we see? Well, three. And the two birth narratives in Matthew and Luke, they don't mention how many wise men there are, but it's presumed there are three because there are three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So, you know, but the thing is, when you talk to people and they say things like the three wise men and Mary on a donkey, that's part of their Bible. They don't think this is, they think this is just how the story goes. And it struck me how human a writer Paul was, where Paul is talking about this rock that follows the Israelites through the desert. Paul's doing the same thing we do when it comes to this this notion of Mary and the three wise men. I just find that to be so, on one level, just really disruptive.
Yeah,
Paul,
absolutely.
Come on, Paul, get it right. On the other hand, so typical of the Christian faith that the humanness of it all is not sort of swept to the side. And we don't have like an up there and a distant God. We have a God who is involved with us and allows us sort of to perceive things the way we perceive things. But it was an early thing that really began changing for me how I thought about just what the Bible is and what does it mean to read it well and what's the character of the Bible? How does it behave? And at that point, I really made a decision that I'm going to pay attention to how it behaves. I don't want to. I tell this story in the Bible Tells Me So, but I came out of that huge lecture hall after hearing James Fugel say this. And I remember walking to my bicycle on the bike rack, and I just stood there staring at my bicycle. I slung my knapsack over my back, and I said, "Toto, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore." I knew something had to happen at that point, and I knew I had choices. I could either make believe I didn't hear what I just heard and go on, you know, plugging my ears going, la, 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 I do not hear you. Or I could have said, yeah, I know what I think I heard, but I'm going to spend my life defending the Bible against this sort of thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, you know what, I don't know what's going to happen, but I just have to walk through this door and just do it. And my personality won't allow for any other option but the third option. So that's just what I did.
Yeah, I can relate to so much in my own journey of, I didn't grow up in church. So this whole idea about even just the Bible in general, when I first read it, I just had so many problems and questions and like, why does everybody just seem to be okay with some of these things that happened and not have a very right. critical lens? I was always kind of the weird skeptic guy. And even now, as I think about one of the stories that came up recently as I was trying to talk about it with some people was, I'm a little bit weirded out by this idea that God spoke through a burning bush that didn't have propane to keep on burning and burning and burning, but the bush just kept burnt. Like, what is anybody else kind of like, why doesn't that still happen today? Why doesn't God speak to me through a bush? So there were these stories that I'd read that I would wonder about, like, okay, did that literally happen? Is there something metaphorical going on here? What's the message? But if I'd bring it up, it would be a little bit like, I was the doubter, come on, Gary, you just accept the Bible for what it says. Just, you need to just read it and then do what it says, that kind of mentality. And I began to become more and more uncomfortable with that, to where I finally allowed myself to move into a stream of different ways of thinking. And, you know, like I said, your book was one of the first ones to kind of free me. And the beautiful thing is that I feel so much more free, and I have way more respect and reverence for Scripture than I did before. And it's kind of fascinating that nobody would say that about me. They'd be like, well, Gary, you clearly don't respect the infallibility, inerrancy, those kinds of things. And now you're leading people to hell.
I think that's, again, your people who say that are overstating, but you might not agree with their theology of how the Bible works.
Yeah.
But I would like to see the Christian world get a little bit looser about allowing people to exist, given that they perceive things differently.
Yeah.
And that doesn't always happen. You know, I mean, people say that to me, you know, similar to you, they say, like, I go on and on, I talk about stuff, and they say, you're attacking the Bible.
Mm.
I say, no, I'm attacking you. You don't understand the difference. That's the problem. And it is the problem. We have a way of looking at the Bible that's, well, this is the right way.
Yeah.
My goodness gracious. I mean, this text has been talked about and written about and pored over by both Jews and Christians for, you know, Jews much longer, let's say about 2,500 years. It's ambiguous. It's not the clearest piece of literature ever written. It's got bits and pieces that don't fit together. It's got contradictions. I'm sorry. It's got tensions. It's got differences of opinion. It has different historical contexts. I mean, it's just ready to be engaged thoughtfully and not be simply – it's almost like it's God's little joke against inerrantists. You know, oh, you okay, here. You want to be an inerrantist? Fine. Here's the book. Good luck with that. You know, maybe there's another thing. Maybe there's something else that is of more value to us than simply having a text that is super clear and gives us all the answers that we for questions that we happen to think are important, right? Instead of trying to let the Bible be the Bible and trying to figure out what are the questions being asked and how are they answering those questions?
Yeah.
Why are they answering the questions that way? But doing that from a context of faith.
Okay, so I want to go back to a little bit of more about your journey in specific. So one of the things I'm very curious about getting your thoughts on is, you know, as you go through this journey of rethinking the way you allow the Bible to be what it is, as you look back, is there anything specific that you'd say, I held to this particular belief about God, Jesus, the Bible, that you now realize, like, wow, that was pretty destructive to me and to others. Is there an example of that? And then how did you go about reforming or re-understanding this particular belief or idea about spirituality?
Yeah. Boy, yeah, there are a number of things, but maybe to stick closest to the topic of you know, the Bible tells me so.
Yeah.
I'd say it's probably letting go of any notion of inerrancy the way it's normally conceived, at least in the modern world today, in the evangelical and fundamentalist world. That's probably the thing that, to me, created so much cognitive dissonance as I tried to think. You know, it was always a matter for me of how can I make this thing work?
Yeah.
And the more I read the Bible, the less it worked.
Yeah, I can relate.
I mean, I know that sounds really – that sounds condescending. I don't mean it that way. I just – you know, I can't – the Bible affirms that there are heavenly board meetings with Yahweh at the head and all the other gods gathered around him. Okay. That's an inerrant piece of information, or is that an ancient cultural way of depicting the divine realm?
Right? Okay, yeah.
So I don't think inerrancy can explain things like that. I don't think inerrancy explains why gospels differ or why there are different traditions of Israel's past in the Old Testament. I don't think it can account well for why biblical laws in Exodus, Deuteronomy, and Leviticus and Numbers, why they differ, why they don't say the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think those are reasons that sort of propelled me in a certain direction. And the process of like formulating maybe another way of thinking about the Bible, and for me, it's probably different than a lot of people because I was in an intense environment like graduate school, you know, where there are a lot of people around me who were already modeling different ways of thinking about the Bible. And I was sort of like soaking it all in.
Yeah.
And then reading things and just keep soaking it in. And that's something that not everybody has the privilege to do that because they have normal lives. I was a monk for a few years pretty much, you know, and things you know how it is. You just have an insight in your life, right? You guys have had this too, where you hear something and something just clicks and that's it.
Oh, yeah.
That's how it works. You know, well, I've had many of those that come at me from places I don't even expect it, from something I read or hear that just says, oh my goodness gracious, that like eight tumblers just fell right into place with that one sentence. And I think it's a series of those things over years that have brought me to a different way of articulating the Bible that just makes the most sense to me and that I think is worth thinking about and talking about.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. So as you moved forward, so like growing up for me, one of the ways that a lot of people that I grew up reading the Bible with, it was like a study tool, you know, like read to learn more, read to study more, read to memorize more, and then just kind of accrue more knowledge about God and the divine and always have your highlighter and all that kind of stuff. So as you move forward in sort of letting the Bible be the Bible, sort of reading it as it is, there are times where I find it really difficult to even want to pick up the Bible because I'm like, I don't know how to read it now because I used to read it like a textbook. So, you know, I'm asking for a friend here. But
A.K.A. you.
A.K.A. me. How do you begin to start moving forward in reading the Bible after coming to an experience like this?
Right. I think that's a very difficult question, but a very important one to ask. And I wish I had a pamphlet to give people, like, here's how you do it. It's really easy. Take these steps. How you do it? You know, but it doesn't work that way.
Give us the next acronym to replace SOAP or whatever. Yeah. The ones we've heard.
Yeah.
But you see, I think you're putting it very well, Kyle, that you used to read the Bible for information about God. It was sort of a textbook. Mm-hmm. And you know it well, and then you pass the test. Mm-hmm. And I think a word that has meant a lot to me over the years, well, several words that sort of come together for me, like journey. Faith is a journey. It's not control of information. There is a pilgrimage dimension, but also reading the Bible specifically. I mean, I like Walter Brueggemann, who uses words like imagination. Oh, that's a bad thing. No, that's a very good thing. That's part of what makes us human. Who has imagination if not human beings? My dogs and cats don't. I guarantee you they do not. Right? They poop on the carpet. They don't have any imagination, all right? So I think that's part of being human and being creative and imaginative. And I try to read the Bible not so much asking myself, which is a typical evangelical thing, I'm going to read this now. What can I get out of it today to, quote, apply to my life? I'd rather just say, okay, wow, that was a bizarre story, and then move on, but then keep coming back to these things and learning to sort of more enter the biblical world than sort of dragging it into mine. I don't have a pamphlet for that. I don't have a way. Here's how you do that. I just think you have to say, listen, I don't want to do the other thing. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask a different set of questions. I want to ask things like why. See, this is, I mean, Rob Bell just has a book that came out, What is the Bible?
I'm going to see him tomorrow. I'm pumped for it.
Really? Oh,
yeah,
fantastic. Okay.
Going to one of his events, yeah.
Oh, good. So he has, I mean, I read the book. I don't memorize it, but he has one place, like the kinds of questions you need to learn to ask about the Bible, which are not very evangelical questions, but they're, I think, very good questions like, okay, why was this even written? And why was this kept? And what did the people who wrote this and kept it, what would they benefit from by keeping this text as part of their lives? You know, why would the ancient Israelites so keep such a diverse text that we call the Old Testament, where you have diverse laws and even laws that don't get along very well? Why is there such diversity? Why do you have this tradition that they were adamant to keep of lament where things aren't going right? You know, you have 150 Psalms, half of them, something's going wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's not like somebody thought of, I think I'll write 150 Psalms and that's it. There were many, many, many Psalms. These were kept as part of their sacred tradition. And the lament Psalms are there. The prophets have a lot of lament. Job and Ecclesiastes are expressions of what do you say when things don't go according to plan, when in fact the plan isn't working. And, you know, this is the kind of Bible we have. And that will drive us to ask, maybe not so much, not to foreground our own questions, but to ask, why did they do that? What are they saying about the nature of faith and even the nature of God by having a book like this that they prize and hold on to and that they keep coming back to over 2.5 millennia now? But you see, that's, I mean, you know, Kyle, that's not the easiest thing to communicate to somebody in a Sunday morning after church. That is the problem here, is that that is a culture shift. That is a drastic and dramatic culture shift that you can't force on people. They have to be ready for that. They have to, it's sort of like, you have to, like Alcoholics Anonymous, you have to be sick and tired of being sick and tired. And you have to be looking for another way. And people have to get there on their own.
Oh, man. And that is one of the biggest challenges, to allow, like, it, you know, I feel like, here's one of my things, is I feel like I got my world opened up to a whole new, more refreshing and life-giving way of approaching God through Scripture. Yeah. And I want to talk to people about it, but it's like some people just kind of look at me like, what? Like, that's
right.
That sounds off. It doesn't sound like that should work for you. And so, right. Yeah, that's one of the big tensions I feel.
That is the problem, isn't it? Because it's your, see, that's just it. You're excited about it.
Yeah, I'm so pumped.
Every bit of trouble I've ever gotten into is exactly that. Because I'm like, this is liberating and exciting. And this has opened up a door where I thought something went about 1 or 2 feet in. It goes 100 miles in.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, is like, isn't this exciting? But you see, here's the thing, too. The problem is that some people are really driven by and motivated by the world of ideas. And not everybody is. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't make them bad people. It's just not everybody likes having their brains twisted into a knot. Some people do. And they wind up going to seminary or something, you know. But not everybody's like that. I think not everyone – in fact, I know just – psychologically, this is true, although I don't have the statistics in the back of my head here. But the likelihood that there's a certain percentage of population of the earth that doesn't do well with abstract thinking.
Yeah.
And so you can't turn things around. You're just not interested in turning things around, saying, yeah, what if, let's look at this thing from a different angle. That doesn't make them bad people. I literally, I'm not just saying this. I have friends of mine who are like that. You just, I can't get into abstract analytical kinds of discussions on any level because they're just not, they're not set up for that, so to speak. And unfortunately, a lot of those people find themselves in church, so, you know, and you can't always have discussions because church gives you that sense of certainty and that sense of, like, you know how things work pretty much. You may have to tweak one or two things, but you have it all pretty much down, and it's right here in this Bible that God gave us. And because God gave it to us, clearly it has to be absolutely clear and straightforward. God would not, quote, lie to us or make it confusing for us. He wants to have the answer. He wants us to have the answer, and here it is. And, you know, you cannot deconstruct that mentality against somebody's will. Mm-hmm. They have to be willing to do it. They have to ask for it. And what I see myself doing in a lot of what I write in my podcast or whatever is trying to hold out an alternate way of looking at things for people when they're ready. They say, oh, there's that thing happening over there that is different. And there, you're seeing somebody tomorrow who does that too, you know, in a different level, in a different way for different people. But it's the same idea. Here's a different paradigm. Here's a different model that isn't simply beholden to the way people are used to looking at things.
You know, I don't, yeah. At this point, I don't even really care so much about our audience because what you just said was so helpful to me.
You'll get my bill.
yeah, I'll make sure the check gets sent out early next week. But yeah, seriously, I mean, and that is one of the huge challenges I face is, like, I want to talk about this new way to understand this that really, like, I mean, I love how you talked about, like, there's 100 different ways that this text can take you into the mystery of understanding this God.
Yeah.
And yeah, but people just aren't ready. And so how do you let that be what it is? And then, but just, I don't know. But be ready for the moment that they go, wait a minute, there's something to what you're saying here. Let's talk more. Mm-hmm.
And if you're in a church that, let's say, for all sorts of reasons, doesn't value the journey that you're on, how can I get them to see? Well, you might not be able to, and some people might wind up having to, you know, leave the church where they are. And I don't advocate that as sort of a simple thing to do, because it's actually very complicated. I mean, I know people who stay in church when they're miserable because they have a lot of connections there with people, including their family. And so they decide to stay, and they decide not to raise these issues in that context because it's not helpful for the greater good. I admire that. When people do that for the sake of their husband or wife or children or whatever, that they're going to stay put, even though they get nothing out of it. You know, simply. And the thing is, it's not just they get nothing out of it, is that they know that they're not valued for who they are.
Yeah.
And I get that. I understand it. You know, it's a hard decision to make, but I respect them for making it.
Oh, that's such helpful stuff, man. You know, we only got a couple more minutes left. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. So I've got a couple, and we'll see if these take a long time to answer. I'm sure they could. But could you just maybe address some of a couple other of these terms that get used for the Bible? Inspiration and authority. What do those mean to you now in your journey?
I'm working that out. I don't mind saying that. I'm trying to think of what does that actually look like. But for example, you know, let's take the second word briefly, authority, authoritative for what? A friend of mine uses an analogy of reading something like The Lord of the Rings. And you would never think of saying, you know, this book is authoritative in that in book two, chapter six, this verse here is what we do, but more as a whole, it captures the imagination, and it takes a let's call it an authoritative role in shaping your life overall.
Okay,
so that's a different way of thinking of authority. Not authority like here's a law book, but here's something casting a vision. It's complex, but here's something casting a vision for the, let's call it, the nature of reality, even, and that gives shape to your life. Something you have to keep living into and contemplating and thinking through and working through, right? That's a different kind of authority. Inspiration, again, it's one of these words that it's almost like a conversation ender in some people. You know, the Bible's inspired. What does that mean, though? And, you know, I wrote a book about, I don't know, 12 years ago now, Inspiration and Incarnation, where I try to make the basic point that inspiration is never divorced from our human context, because we never apprehend God out there someplace. God is always in the midst of us, which is, I think, just the nature of the Christian God, and I would say the God of Judaism as well. And, you know, inspiration is not – okay, inspiration is a difficult to articulate meshing together of the divine will and of human context.
Okay.
And God is okay. I mean, I put it this way, and the Bible tells me so. God lets his children tell the story from their point of view. See, to me, that's a way of thinking about inspiration. God lets his children tell the story of their experience from their point of view, from their ancient point of view. So, you know, ancient peoples, you know, what makes a god great? It's the god that lets you beat up other people and take their land, right? that is, you can call that inspired in the sense that this is God allowing the ancient Israelites to talk about God in the only way that would make sense to them in that culture. Inspiration does not guard 100% accuracy. In other words, right? See, inspiration already has a fragility built into it because you're dealing with people. And God doesn't steamroll over people. I think God lets people be people. And that's what C.S. Lewis calls the offense of the incarnation. It's like this is like we wouldn't think of a religion like this where God is so willing to participate in this human realm that we all live in.
Yeah. Oh, helpful stuff, man. Okay, I got one final question for you.
Here.
So you spend a lot of time traveling, speaking, teaching, all over country and the world, just talking about the Bible, meeting other Christians in different, all kinds of different contexts. So for you, where do you see glimmers of hope for the Christian church and followers of Jesus?
Boy, I don't feel competent to answer that question, only because there's so much of the world church that I just don't see or understand. And I catch glimmers of that from people who live in parts of the world I've never visited and who experience things that I don't experience. So I don't think I can speak to the whole, I guess, but okay, at least from the little part of the world that I engage with, you know, I think there's a lot of hope because there are a lot of people out there who are not hindered by defending the Bible or defending their faith. Yeah. They're just sort of doing it. And I look at that as a very comforting and inspiring thing for myself. And, you know, we have to remember that the struggles that those of us who are involved or have been involved or who were raised in, again, that American evangelical fundamentalist context, that's not normal Christianity. That's not the way it's always been until recently. That's a sociological aberration of the last 100 years or so. And there are a lot of people out there who are actually following Jesus who don't even, you know, we had somebody on our podcast, you know, it's not going to be aired for a while, but we asked her, she's a professor and an Episcopalian, about, you know, did studying the Bible from a modern criticism point of view, like a scholarly point of view, how did that affect your faith? And she said, I don't even know what you're talking about, because I was never raised where this was a problem.
Wow.
You know, and that's just and to say, well, you're not really a Christian. No, lighten up there, Sparky. Sure she is. You know? And but they just don't see it the way you do. And I think part of what can be really unsettling for people is to see their own way of looking at the world from that evangelical fundamentalist point of view, to have that relativized by the fact that just get out a little bit and you'll see how few people even understand what you're talking about.
Yeah.
How many Christians don't understand what you're talking about?
Oh man, Pete, this has been great.
Thanks.
I so appreciate your voice as it relates to all this. And again, you know, what you have shared in your writings and now your podcast that I've been listening to regularly, it's just been, I hate using this phrase because we use it all the time, but like it's been life changing for me, honestly. Like
it has
expanded my world of understanding who God is and how God is present with me in this life. And so just thank you for being one of those leading voices that's willing to put it all out there and say, hey, let's look at it maybe in a different way and pose new thoughts. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. I appreciate it. That's very kind of you to say.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for spending some time with us today, man. And
what happened to Kyle? He left us. He blipped out. Did he get raptured or something? Or?
You know, I think so. We might have gotten.
Did you believe in that sort of thing? What happened?
I think it happened when we started talking about inerrancy. He just he got taken
up.
So. Yeah.
Couldn't handle it. So.
Oh man! Well, tell us how we can find out more about you and what you're up to.
Well, I have a website, PeteEnns.com. Also, the Bible for Normal People. .com, same thing. And you can find out there about speaking schedule. And, you know, I blog a couple times a week. And now there's a podcast that comes out pretty much every week, although we're going to be changing that pretty soon because it's summer.
Yeah.
And we have a life. And I have a house. And I have grass that has to be cut and that kind of stuff. So, but we'll probably go back every other week. We will go back to every week come fall again for the entire fall and winter. And so there's, you know, some my books are there too if you're interested in that sort of thing. So that's probably the best place to go.
Yeah, and I have to make a plug for myself right now.
Go ahead.
If somebody were to sign up on Patreon to be one of our patrons, we will send you one of Pete's books. So you should totally do that.
Wow.
Because we want you to read it and we want to give that as a gift. But last question. Are you working on anything right now as far as like the next book or am I allowed to ask that? Or
yeah, you can ask it. I'm working I'm trying to get clarity on a topic that I'm already under contract to write with right. Harper One. This is with Harper One again. And right now, the gist of it is something like this, something like 10 or 12 or 15 passages that basically blew me out of the water and brought me to rethink what I believed.
Oh my gosh, sign me up. I'm can't wait for that. I mean,
it's either passages or stories in the Bible that maybe say, "Okay, wait a second here. What's going on?" And blew me out of the water for the better. You know, not like, "Oh no." But it's more like, "Oh wow." this is so good it's actually scary in a sense. So that's what I'm working on, and I'm trying to work on what those 10, 12, or 15 things are and how to say it and all that kind of stuff.
Right on. Well, that sounds fantastic. Can't wait for that one to come out. So thanks again, Pete. We appreciate you being with us here at Voices.
You bet. See ya.
All right. See ya.
Thanks.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Voices podcast. If you want to get the links for anything we talked about today, they will be in the show notes on patreon.com/voicespodcast. If you go there, you can scroll down to the episode and you will see all the links right there.
And if you're interested in becoming a supporter of the show, we are on Patreon. So you can go to our Patreon website and you'll see different levels of supporting the show. That helps us to get different guests on the show, put more time and resources to this. And one of the things we want to do is be a resource to you on your spiritual journey. That was the whole vision behind this in the first place. So one of those ways we do that is at different levels, there are different resources that we'll make available to you as you are working through reimagining faith.
We also want you to be able to join the conversation with us. So make sure you leave us a comment on Facebook or tweet at us on Twitter. We are Voices Podcast on Facebook and at Voices Pod on Twitter. Let us know what you thought, agreed with, disagreed with, and what you want to hear more about.
All right. Thanks for listening.